This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, it felt fitting as we get ready to turn the calendar page again to a new year to celebrate a person and a company that had and will have milestones. We'll chat with the founder and the head of the Naxos label and Naxos distribution, Klaus Heyman. Klaus is German-born, but after studies in Frankfurt and London, he found himself in the Far East as editor of a U.S. weekly newspaper, but also selling high-end sound equipment for Bose and Revox, as well as dabbling in distribution for some smaller classical labels. In staging concerts to help promote his sound equipment, he embarked on a journey of which he can be all too happy of its occurrence. He met his wife, violinist Takako Nishizaki, and the desire to record her talent and showcase her in both standard repertoire for violin and unknown works led to the formation of the Marco Polo label. When Klaus simply wanted to make CDs available in his region at the cost of a then LP, it led through various fortuitous circumstances to the founding of the Naxos label. The low-budget range pricing raised eyebrows among those in the industry, but gradually the label took hold through solid performances, a steady but slow buildup of good reviews, and the buying public realizing that CDs of interest and exploration do not need to cost $15 to $20. Retailers reacted to the sales by allotting Naxos prime real estate in their stores, sales recognition awards followed, many of those, and Naxos grew now to the largest distributor of classical music in the world, distributing over 700 labels in addition to Naxos, with more than 85,000 active titles. Naxos led the way in audiobooks on CD and on the video platforms, most notably DVDs. But Klaus, always the visionary and reactionary, also led the way on not only music downloading, but also music streaming that has translated in millions having access to classical music who might otherwise not, plus nearly 3,000 institutions who subscribe to the Naxos Music Library worldwide, including over 1,700 in North America. There are too many eye-popping numbers about Naxos to relate here. One tremendously encouraging set of numbers, which I'll highlight in this program, is of the label's top-selling 15 CDs this past year, 2016, over half are recordings of American composers, with nearly all of them being living American composers. And it will and does continue, as Klaus turned 80 this past September and Naxos turns 30 this coming year. As important CD after important CD continues to be released, you're listening to a disc you've heard a lot of on the station, as it is our holiday CD of the month, music by British composer James Whitburn, his Caroline Music for Christmas, with the Westminster Williamson Voices from Westminster Choir College of Rider University, led by Dr. James Jordan. This the opening track by Mr. Whitburn, Veni et Illumina, Come and Give Light, something Klaus and Naxos have been doing for decades. I caught up with Klaus at his hotel room in New York City back in September when he was in for some 80th birthday honors.
Thank you. Thank you again for meeting. I'm here with Klaus Heyman. Between the time we're recording this and be the time I air this, you will celebrate your 80th birthday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So just kind of an obvious question. Over your career, has age ever played a factor as goals or signposts of things you wanted to meet at certain ages, or has it just been whatever?
No, it's been a pretty straightforward development. We obviously pioneered a lot of things in the online field. We had the first streaming site in 1996 for a label. We put all our content up on one streaming site for promotion and marketing purposes. We had the first streaming subscription site, Naxos Music Library, in 2002. Mm-hmm. We had the first 80-channel pre-programmed radio in 2005, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 2004. So we've always been ahead of our times when it came to online digital distribution. Because we've had the foresight or the good luck of gambling on the internet, we are in a better financial position than most of our competitors, which enable us to buy up quite a few of those. We own Orfeo, we own Ondine, Capriccio, Dynamic, Propius, and a few others. And as the industry suffers from streaming, we'll probably sign up others.
But I was just curious, from a personal standpoint, did you ever say, well, I'm coming up on my 50th, I'm coming up on my 60th birthday, I'm glad I've accomplished this. You never took it as personal signposts for your age?
Never played a role, and except now I have to think, you know, if I tackle new projects, can I finish them within the next 10 years, you know? So I was nowadays, we work on an online encyclopedia of classical music. I've told the lady who is the editor, you know, make sure it's finished before my 90th birthday. I want to see it myself.
That's a nice deadline to give her.
Yeah.
As you just rattled off some things here for our listeners, when someone reaches the level of degree of success and accomplishment you have, usually there's labels that attract themselves, and visionary is one that makes sense. I believe visionaries also have to be reactionaries. So, again, can you cite some things that over the years you, as a visionary, saw coming and they came true? And maybe some things that surprised you and you had to react to it. I mean, I know there's can be many things, but I'm just curious.
I'm always flattered if people call me a visionary, but in reality, I was able to try out almost everything because I owned the company. I was the only decision maker, and some of the decisions I made, my people thought I was crazy. Mm-hmm. So when I read in, I think, 1994 in Wall Street Journal or New York Times, that the internet would be the future of music distribution. We had a little website which I'd never paid any attention to. The guy managing our warehouse actually was sort of an amateur developer. He had started the site. Then I went to the site and said, oh my God, you know, it was 3D, it took 5 minutes to load and everything. He said, look, let's start again from scratch. And that's when we came up with this first streaming site where we had our Naxos Marco Polo label. So but it's something I had read, something we were sort of remotely into already, and then I really forced the development of that. When downloads started, I think in 2004, iTunes launched in 2003, I had a foresight, and it's somewhere still on the internet, to say, well, downloads are not the future of the business, it's streaming. Once the cell phones and mobile device have a flat rate, of course, at the time, streaming music probably would have cost you $1 a minute because of the data were so expensive. And that has come through in the meantime. Most people now listen to music on their mobile devices. So I had a few. I got the DVD right when, I think, 1998 or 99, our German company was offered the distribution of the Art House DVD label. My GM called me and said, Mr. Heyman, this has been offered to me. Should I take it? I said, take it for the world. I realized right away this is the next medium that we could sell very well alongside our CDs. So we signed up Art House for the world, and then all the others came to us. EuroArts, C Major, we have almost everybody right now.
Yeah, you do.
So these were the three crucial things, recognizing or at least reading about the internet and then going full blast into it, the DVD, and also anticipating the streaming revolution.
This is the Slavonic Dance No. 1 in B major from the Opus 72 set by Dvorak, the Slovak Philharmonic led here by Zdeněk Košle, released in the mid-80s on the Enigma Classics label, a sub-imprint of Naxos, and Klaus's first foray into global CD releases at a low and very affordable price. In fact, at the time, only a dollar more than your budget cassette.
Mentioned this last time we talked, I'll go back even further for one more, and that was back in the late 80s. Just the whole pricing thing, because I was at the front lines. I was managing the Tower Record Store in Philadelphia, and when you came out with your test balloon, which was those Enigma things at $4.99, and I heard everybody in the industry say, he's crazy. Well, that's history now.
You know, I started with Marco Polo in 1982, yeah. And then when CD price started coming down in 85, 86, I decided this is something we can do. But with the orchestras we had, we could not compete with Vienna Philharmonic, Berlin Philharmonic, not in standard repertoire. Marco Polo had done rarities. People were willing to buy the Respighi Violin Concerto with the Singapore Symphony Orchestra, right. But they wouldn't buy Beethoven's cycle or Brahms. So my only choice was to make a mark was to sell a CD at the price of an LP. That was a very simple commercial thing. I didn't see big risk. By the time we came to the US market through Enigma, it was already a big success in Europe. That was a mistake to do with Enigma. They didn't understand the business. They redesigned everything, and only after we set up our own company a couple of years later did we become successful in the US.
Yeah. When we spoke 4.5 years ago, which was for Naxos's 25th anniversary, now 2017 will be the 30th anniversary. Again, congratulations. You mentioned back then, we were talking about physical CDs, and you said your best guess was a lifespan of 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. You've also been quoted as saying you're going to be the last man standing to deliver people classical music in a physical format. Do you, amend that, or do you want to give us sort of an up-to-date status of the physical CD for those that still collect it, want it in their hand, and enjoy it?
Well, the development for the CD does not proceed at the same speed in all markets.
Right.
In the UK, in Japan, in Germany, we still have a pretty healthy physical market because there's still shops. The problem in the United States is there are no more shops.
Right.
And the main shop is now Amazon. Then there's AEC One Stop, and the third biggest shop is already our own archive mail order business.
Right.
That's why the decline in physical sales is much greater in the US than in the other main markets. France is also problematic because they have one big chain dominating the market, they're cutting back. So I think that was 4 or 5 years ago, I said 5 to 10 years. Now I say it's at least still 5 years. I think there will always be a physical product of some sort because the artists want to have a calling card. They want to have something to sell at their concerts. And unless there's another fantastic format comes up, it will still be the CD.
Music we'll hear in this program from audio CD releases are from the top-selling CD list for Naxos for 2016. This from a CD of piano music by American composer, educator, performer, and author Bruce Adolph, played by Carlo Grante. This is the movement Jazzerka from Adolph's Chopin Dreams. Thank you.
The other thing that's changed over the last 4.5 years is Naxos has exploded as a distributor. Always were a distribution, but now there's 700 labels somewhere in that region. In the U.S. alone, the warehouse carries like something like 85,000 titles.
Yes.
So now some of these labels are small. They're very niche labels, niche even beyond Naxos's seeking out the undiscovered gems. Some of these titles that get released by these labels are going to appeal to very few people. What's the thinking behind bringing so many labels under the Naxos umbrella? Is it just to have all that content? I mean, what has been the thing? Because it's a drastic, it's great because these labels haven't disappeared. You have given them life. But I'm just wondering what the thinking is behind that.
Well, we are discussing this thinking right now because even the smallest label make work, and some of the smallest label make the most work because they release so few records that every record for them is a very important project. And so they will call, what happened with our record? We couldn't find it, it's not been reviewed. You know, I said, look, we have 700 labels. Some labels release 10 recordings a month or 20 recordings a month, you know. They don't understand that we just don't have the manpower or woman power in our case very often to focus on a release of a tiny little label that hardly has any market recognition. So we're looking at this, we want to at least make them available.
Right.
That means make them available on Amazon, make them available on our archive label, but we won't be able to do very much else for them.
Well, the other area that's changed, has grown a lot since we met last, are what you would call cottage industry recordings, meaning specific ensembles, orchestras putting out their own recordings, even solo artists putting out their own recordings. Is there an interest also to try to gather them, some of them, under the Naxos umbrella so that they too can have... I know many of them are made, as you said, as calling cards, as business cards, as promotional items.
Well, we distribute, I think, probably the majority of the orchestra's own labels somewhere. Yeah. We have the LPO worldwide, we have Dallas, we have Seattle, we have Atlanta, and quite a few more, you know. And we have our Gil Shams label.
Right, yeah. Can I recall that?
I mean, if an artist makes a recording on his own and is able to sell those CDs at concerts, then it makes sense for them to produce their own their own brand, you know. But in the majority of cases, they still need a record label. And if they come to us with a ready-made master, we look at what it is. Is it really well played? But is it a repertoire that we're not really interested in? We make it available digitally online, and we press CDs on demand. So the artist has as many as he can have CDs if he wants to. We now have this short-run manufacturing capability in Nashville.
Yeah.
We install that in Japan and in Germany as well. If the artist has come to something which is interesting to us because of the repertoire, we may then release it as a normal Naxos CD. And then the next level is we go to the artist or the artist, this is what he would like to do. And then we make a contribution to the production cost, or we actually pay our normal fees. And so there are different stages of interest for us, different types of interest.
It's just that whole thing is expanding, as I see, as I deal with artists.
Naxos Audiobooks releases number in the thousands of titles. But even from the very first releases, they integrated great classical music in with the reading of great literature, as this brief excerpt from Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, read by Bill Holmwood, with the music of Berlioz, illustrates.
On the following afternoon, extraordinary noises broke out in Paris. They resembled shots and the clamors of a multitude. Father Mabeuf saw a gardener passing and inquired, "What is it?" The gardener, spade on back, replied in the most unconcerned tone, "Oh, that's the riots. They're fighting." Nothing is more extraordinary than the first breaking out of a riot. Everything bursts forth everywhere at once. They pillaged a factory of small arms on the Boulevard Saint-Martin. and three armourers' shops, the first in the Rue Beaubourg, the second in the Rue Michel de Comte, the third in the Rue du Temple. In a few minutes, the thousand hands of the crowd had seized and carried off 230 guns, nearly all double-barreled, bayonets, 64 swords, and 83 pistols.
I want to zoom out a bit, because I think another thing that's made what you've done so important, and I don't think regular listeners or even CD buyers, collectors realize this, there's Naxos the label, and there's all the sub-labels you've had, or Naxos the American series, all those kind of American classics, invaluable. There's the distribution we just talked about, making all these things according. But there's so many other things you have done, Naxos has done over the years, which make the opportunity for people to hear classical music there when they may not, it may be even subtle. Few things. The whole Naxos book and audiobook line, every single recording is backed with classical music. So if somebody's buying it simply for the literary content to hear the story, they're getting exposed to classical music. Brilliant. Streaming, you've talked about. And not only streaming, but 3,000 institutions of educational nature now pick you up and make that music available
and to students. And national libraries and municipal libraries and so on.
Naxos licensing, which you've done for decades, but making sure classical music has a chance to be into mainstream media such as movies and television, all the rest of that stuff. The musicology aspect, you have actually have research ends of Naxos, like the Atari edition, scores printing, your wife's violin studio, Naxos Foundation, even now getting into video streaming of concerts, important concerts, and things like this. We talked about visionary. This is a whole plan of making sure people who may not hear classical music hear classical music. And if there's a question there is, these are all connected, are they not, in some way?
Well, first of all, one of my ambitions is to make classical music easily accessible and available. The other aspect is, I recognize that if we want to survive as an industry, we have to educate people. So I invested a lot of money. Naxos Music Library primarily was an educational project. But the books, the A to Zs, the classics explained, opera explained, these are all things we thought we had to do if you want to have the next generation of listeners and classical music lovers. So I think in that respect, maybe I was a bit of a visionary, because we're doing more than the rest of the industry combined,
right,
you know, in terms of the education projects, education platforms, the books. Audiobooks has become a highly profitable sideline. What happened that in, I think, 1995, I was having dinner at Midem with my team, and one of the journalists, whom I knew well, Nicholas Soames, sat next to me and whispered into my ear, Klaus, you should do audiobooks. I said, what's audiobooks? And he explained it to me, and I said, well, who's out there? And at that time, it was books on tape.
Right.
If you went to a bookstore, there were no audiobooks in the CD shops. It was books on tape. I said, look, I'm only interested if you do A, high quality, every title on CD, and every title uses classical music sort of to set the scene for the narration, because that will give us a unique selling point, CD and music to set the scene. And that turned out to be really, really successful. I don't think we're doing it anymore, because we now do 120 CD audiobooks like The Peep's Diaries,
right,
and Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. There's just not enough music to introduce. And what do we do with Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, you know? We don't have enough Roman music.
Can't recycle that Respighi fast enough.
So it was a USP issue.
Yeah, sure.
The Naxos label catalog easily has the most diverse and far-reaching depth of repertoire, but also is not afraid to stretch out. From the disc called Manhattan Intermezzo, featuring pianist Jeffrey Beagle with the Brown University Orchestra led by Paul Phillips, a disc which includes works by Gershwin, Ellington, Neil Sedaka, yes, really, and the three-movement Piano Concerto No. 1 by rocker Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake & Palmer. This is the final movement, titled Toccata con Fuoco. Sadly, Mr. Emerson passed away in March of this year, shortly after this CD was released.
said all that, still, classical music, if you want to put everything under that umbrella, which is the great masterpieces, the undiscovered gems, the newest music, put all that under that, whatever you want to call it, it still is hard to make inroads. And let's talk about the U.S. right here. Hard to make inroads, hard to make it register on people of all age groups. It doesn't get covered like probably should. You open up a mainstream magazine, if it's music, it's about pop music. So what still needs to be done? What can be done? And if you just want to concentrate on the U.S. market, that's fine, because all other markets are different on how music sort of permeates and the heritage they bring to it and the consciousness they bring to it and the value they bring to it. But what about the U.S. market? I mean, classical music has made great inroads. I mean, it's much better than it was. The doom and gloom of 10, 15 years ago in the press is gone. It's much better than when you and I talked 4.5 years ago. However, still, it's getting that wider base to know and explore and discover.
Well, I mean, look, classical music has always been around here in the States between 3 and 4% of total music sales. Even in the heyday, 50s and 60s, the percentage was never much higher. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Europe, classical music, Germany, Austria, England, for a long time, got close to 10% of total music sales. So I don't think we're doing that much worse today. And actually, I think we do a lot better, because if we count all those people listening online, we reach a lot more people now with classical music than ever before.
Right.
And kids are used to classical music from video games. There are a lot of orchestral video game soundtracks. They know classical music from the movies, from House of Cards has an orchestral soundtrack, you know. So I don't think there is a big problem about classical music. Where the problem is live concerts, where the audience are graying or whitening, you know, and it's partly a function of the orchestra not being very enterprising, because they don't want to upset the existing old clientele by program for younger clientele. Some orchestras run two series, one for the traditional white-haired audience and one for younger people.
Right.
But I think orchestras could be more enterprising in their programming, in the way they present concerts. I mean, here in the States, a lot more experimentation than in Europe, where everything is state-funded, where people don't have to experiment because the government always pays the bill. Mm. I think there are a lot of experiments going on in this country, and some are successful, some fail, and have to try something else.
That divide has always been there between the people who will attend concerts, the people who will buy recordings, and that gulf. I mentioned one of the things Naxos is doing is sort of looking into streaming live concerts that are important. Maybe they have a premiere on them or something like that. Do you see a way of taking a live concert experience and turning that person who attends, whatever their age, whatever their experience of going first concert, long-time concert goer, into then wanting to do something with a Naxos product, whether it's download the video, whether it's go get a recording? I mean, to try to make that link so there's some kind of follow-up. It's not just a one-night experience of 2 hours from 8 to 10 o'clock.
Well, we've experimented with making free album downloads available to people who go to a concert of one of our artists.
Right. Yeah.
Didn't do very well.
Okay.
Some workers have experimented with burning a CD of the concert right there at the concert.
Right.
So people could go home with a recording of the thing they had just attended, you know. But it turned out to be not so successful. People were not willing to pay, and it was a big effort, you know, to record a concert and load it on the burner and then print a cover or have a cover. So it was not so successful. Otherwise, more orchestras would have done it. I mean, it's the only thing you can do, you can advertise to the people in the house programs or pass out a leaflet, which we do sometimes in Hong Kong. We pass out a leaflet advertising on Naxos Music Library, also not very successful. The audiences are too different. People who go to concerts are not the same people who buy CDs or listen online.
Yeah. I always wondered whether, like, what we would call here a surcharge, like if you're going to pay $40 to go hear the Seattle Symphony, but if you'd pay $5 more, you can walk out with a recording in the concert you just heard, and they put it on the ticket price.
Yeah.
Some people might not even flinch and say, "Oh yeah, this is my first concert with my 10-year-old son. I want to record a memento of that." You know?
I bear in mind, and I mean, I talk to many of our conductors and music directors, and say, "Look, what do you think?" You
know? Yeah, just trying to connect. Like you said, there is that always has been that disconnect. I mean, I saw it even years ago.
But there's also the, I shouldn't say lethargy, but sort of the people used to doing the same thing. They don't want to do anything that's outside a normal comfort zone. And that's why they don't, it's not so interested in programming. I mean, I just had a meeting with a well-established publisher. They have the rights to some of the soundtracks of the HBO and Netflix movies.
Right.
And they're now editing those programs and then create a soundtrack to go with them for orchestras to play the scenes from House of Cards,
right.
And then play the backing track, you know, live in concert. So, but it's also a big effort. Then they have to organize the screening. Then it's a one-off, unless they do a series, you know. So it's a lot of effort, you know. A lot of people just set in their ways, and that's the way we do concert. They will continue doing them, and eventually we'll have problems.
Naxos is always finding new ways to bring in a new set of listeners, such as their series of DVDs with films that have outstanding soundtracks composed by great composers, by re-recording the soundtracks and printing new DVD editions of the film, such as the case with Mexican composer Silvestre Revueltas and the soundtrack he composed for the 1935 film Redes. Here is some music from the beginning of that soundtrack as performed by the post-classical ensemble led by their music director, Ángel Gil Ordóñez.
No es justo que un hijo muera porque su padre no tuvo dinero para curarlo.
¶¶
Last thing, we did cover this 4.5 years ago, but again, things have changed here over the time, is this media, radio, and what radio means in 2016, I guess, is any way people can get a streaming signal of music, whether it's traditional radio, whether it's some kind of handheld device, which means they are a passive, submissive listener to whatever wants to come their way. How do you see this mixing in the future with what you do and what you're trying to do? I mean, is there still room for what we know as radio, but just defined like I did?
I'm actually very surprised how important radio has remained for classical music. We can see it from the public performance revenue we get from the countries where you get paid by a terrestrial radio station, unlike here in the US where only get paid by online. I think this will continue until we have Wi-Fi along all the major motorways and roads and so on, because then people will switch to online radio.
Right.
But that will still take, I would say, 5 years before every commuter has access to Wi-Fi in his car. Until then, of course, you have access to your mobile phone provider, but it's normally expensive.
Right.
So radio, I think, is primarily a mobile medium. You know, many cars now come installed with Pandora. I just bought two Japanese cars in New Zealand that comes with Pandora and a local version of Pandora built into the... But you need to have access via your phone company and have unlimited data, or they have to have Wi-Fi.
And for a younger generation, my older son, the radio is his phone. He goes in the car, plugs it in, he listens to what he wants through his phone. He doesn't...
Yeah.
The radio is just something with numbers on it he never uses.
Yes, that's right. No, I still listen. When I drive, I still listen to the radio. The moment I get in the car, push the button, and there's classical music. It's every country we go in, it's fixed on the classical music station.
We've talked a lot about stuff that might be right in front of us. Is Naxos's 30th anniversary, 2017. Any divulge anything special that's going to happen this year?
Well, we have a big event in Hong Kong on the day, on October 22nd, where we invite basically everybody who's anything in Hong Kong in the musical world. We'll have some composers attending, quite famous ones. I understand they're planning a surprise for me, which probably means tributes online or video tributes from all the conductors and composers we work with. And I said, don't overdo it. No. So, and then we have a very big event next year in Munich. I think it's May 15 or 16, where we say 110 years of Naxos. And below that will be 80 plus 30. My 80 plus 30 of the label.
Okay.
And then we'll have a concert at the Hofkirche, the court church, the old court church in Munich. I think our Germans think they will have television covering it. And we have our most important house artists performing a recital for about 60 minutes. And then we have a reception, drinks, and as many drinks as people want afterwards. That will be the big event. And that's in conjunction with our annual, we have something called the Naxos Music Market, where all our distributor labels can meet all our distribution companies. That's been growing in importance. It was basically meant to compete with classical media, but then came Classical Next, it's been reasonably successful, which we support the launch of that. So I mean, that will be the big event for the media and everything.
So go back to my first question, your age is actually going to figure into the celebrations.
Yes. Well, I mean, when I told my people was coming to the US this time, I said, look, anybody is interested in covering Naxos 30th anniversary, my PR manager said, look, people are more interested in your 80th than Naxos 30th. And now it also turns out in Germany, I'm doing quite a few distance interviews now about the 80th. And when I get closer to the 30th, I'll be very busy on the phone or on Skype.
Well, let's you and I hook up again at the Naxos 35 and you're 85, and then you'll be up to 120, and we'll keep going from there. You'll still be good.
Well, you have to work at it, you know. I walk 5 kilometers a day, and it's about 3.5 miles. And I've become a radical vegan, fat-free, dairy-free, you know. And it means I'm healthy without pills.
Right.
Which is a good thing, you know, at my age. My golf scores keep getting better because I take video lessons online from Tiger Woods' former coach, Hank Haney. I'll try my best to keep fit.
Yeah, many more years to you. Thanks for taking some time. Always good
to
see you.
Well, you're most welcome. Thank you for it. Any good questions?
Mm-hmm. Klaus Heyman, founder and head of the Naxos label and Naxos distribution. Of course, you can find out anything on Naxos and anything about Naxos at naxos.com. Again, we wish Klaus a very happy 80th birthday year and congratulations on Naxos's upcoming 30th anniversary. As mentioned, nearly all the music I've played on this program comes from Naxos's top 15 sellers of 2016, of which over half are recordings of living American composers. I'll leave you with music from one of those, from my Cadenza guest just 2 weeks ago, Michael Daugherty, from the disc, which contains two concertos, one for cello inspired by Hemingway, one for organ inspired by Hurst's Castle. We'll hear the opening movement from his three-movement work for orchestra inspired by the Iowa-born artist Grant Wood, titled American Gothic. And this movement's title is a good catchphrase for Naxos at this time. It is called On a Roll. The Nashville Symphony is led by Giancarlo Guerrero, music of Michael Daugherty on the Naxos label. My guest today, the founder and head of Naxos, Klaus Heyman. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza programs by going to WWFM.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. The other one.